The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So good morning, everyone. And so the last couple of Sundays, I gave talks on aspects of the Buddha as a teacher. And I'd like to follow up those with a talk today about some of the things the Buddha said about being a student. And because teachers, you know, if you have a teacher, you need a student. And in fact, one of my teachers, one of my Zen teachers, said something that's always been meaningful for me, that it's the student that makes the teacher. That the student-teacher, it's a relationship that goes on, but that it's a student that makes the teacher. And I think of that sometimes because, I'm just going along bumbling through my life until someone comes to me and wants, you know, relates to me as a teacher. And so I don't think of myself normally as a teacher in that way. So it's a relationship. And so what's the nature of that relationship? It's a two-way thing. And so in a way that there are, if you want to be a student, if you want to have someone be a teacher, what are some of the ways in that works? What is required of you? What are the responsibilities of being a student? Some people listen to teachers passively, hoping to get knowledge or inspiration or something. But the tradition is that if you're going to be a student, a practitioner who's a student listening to teachers, that to do it well, you have to go into the situation being willing to change, to be changed. You're not only going in there to have be confirmed in what you already know, but somehow you have to be a willingness to change in the contact with the teachings that you hear. And so is there that willingness? Is there that receptivity? Is there that openness? Is there interest in somehow changing? And it's like if you go to get lessons in something, in a musical instrument or athletics or something, the expectation is that you're going to put some effort in to allow yourself to be changed by the experience. So the same thing with in the teachings of the Buddha, to be a student, you come with certain, in a sense, responsibilities, certain way to be. And so it's interesting to see how the Buddha talked about this. So this is from a text, a sutta, called the Kanki Sutta, or the Buddha's teachings to a Brahmin named Kanki. And this young Brahmin came to the Buddha. Brahmins are the priestly class in India, in ancient India especially. So they were the people responsible for preserving the ancient sacred texts of the Vedas and the various things that were important for the ritual functions of these priests. And so this Brahmin, young Brahmin, he came to the Buddha and he said, I made a statement. He said, in regard to the ancient Brahmanic texts that have come down through oral transmission, the Brahmins come to the definite conclusion, only this is true, anything else is wrong. What does the Buddha say about this? What do you think of this? They say this is the only truth, these ancient texts. These texts come down. So this is an interesting question because in many different religions, people will rely on some text, a scripture, and say only this is true or this is true, and they hold on to it in some way. So here, even 2,500 years ago, people had this approach, and this man comes to the Buddha and says, well, what do you think of this? And the Buddha's reply is to ask a question in return. And he says, among the Brahmins that you know, Brahmins around today, back then, is there a single teacher or a single teacher's teacher he asks the Kanki, among the Brahmins today, is there even a single Brahmin who says the following? I know this, I see this, only this is true, anything else is wrong. So I know and I see means that you know for yourself, personally, directly. So Kanki says, no one knows from direct experience whether these ancient texts are true or not. So then he says, well, in that case, is there a single teacher of Brahmins or a teacher's teacher back seven generations who has said, I know this is true, I see this is true through direct experience? And Kanki says, no. You know, we have no records of anybody saying, you know, seven generations now, really knowing it for themselves. Then how about this, the Buddha says, those ancient Brahmin seers, the creators of the hymns, the composers of the hymns, those ancient hymns that were formerly chanted, uttered, and compiled, that we still chant today, do any of them, have any of them claimed that they knew and saw directly? And the Kanki says, no. No one made the claim to know and see directly. So then the Buddha says something maybe a little bit critical. He says, it seems among the Brahmins there is not even a single Brahmin who would say, I know, I see. Only this is true, anything else is wrong. And among the Brahmins there's not a single teacher or single teacher's teacher back to seven generation. Not even the people who created these hymns say they know and see this directly. Suppose there were a file of blind men, each in touch with the next. The first one does not see, the middle one does not see, and the last one does not see. So too, in regard to their statements, the Brahmins seem to be like a file of blind men. First one does not see, the middle one does not see, and the last one does not see. What do you think, Kanki? That being so, does not the faith of the Brahmins turn out to be groundless? That's pretty strong, I think, language. So is their faith groundless? And so Kanki doesn't answer that question, but rather comes back this way. He says, the Brahmins honor this not only out of faith, Master Gotama, they also honor it as oral tradition. So they're not saying this, well, you know, in addition to their faith that it's true, it's their oral tradition that it's true. Somehow it's passed on from generation to generation. And the Buddha replies, first you took your stand on faith, now you speak of oral tradition. There are five things, they may turn out in two different ways. What five? Faith, approval, oral tradition, reason, cognition, and reflective acceptance of a view. These five things may turn in two different ways. Now something may be fully accepted out of faith, yet it may be empty, hollow, and false. But something else may not be fully accepted out of faith, yet it may be factual, true, and unmistaken. And then he goes through the same thing for the other four. So the five things are faith. You might understand some religious teachings hold it as being true based on faith. And then the second here is, translation here is approval, which I think basically means you like it. And the fact that you like something, you prefer it, doesn't mean that it's true. It might be true and might not be true. The fact that you hold something on faith doesn't mean that it's true necessarily. It might be true and might not be true. And then the next one is oral tradition. Just the fact that it's back then they didn't have written books. The fact that you have these texts, so these oral tradition, the fact that it's the customary for many generations of people doesn't necessarily mean it might be true, it might not be true. You can't be sure just by that. And then the last two are interesting because they're more cognitive. And, reason cognition, so using your reasoning. And the Buddha makes this interesting statement that if you rely only on your reasoning, the results of your reasoning might be true and might not be true. In other words, reasoning by itself is not a good basis for ascertaining the truth or the religious truth. And then reflective acceptance of a view. So this is a little slightly different. This is where there is a teaching that's out there, and you engage in it reflectively, thinking about it, and because you, in your reasoned reflection, it seems like a good idea, then you accept it. So that also, you know, might be true, might not be true. So I think this kind of teaching is, I take it as being pretty radical, pretty challenging, given, I think, a majority of people who believe in religious teachings, probably the ground for their belief is one of these five, or a very big part of it. And here the Buddha is challenging, saying, well, this might not be enough to know the truth. And so I can imagine for some people it's a little bit challenging to hear there, so it pulls the rug from underneath them. Well, if I can't know it based on this, then how do I know what's true? So the Buddha continues in his little statement. Under these conditions, in this way, it is not proper for a wise person who preserves the truth to come to the definite conclusion, only this is true, anything else is wrong. So the fact that you hold something on faith, approval, tradition, reasoning, reflective acceptance, just on those reasons, you can't know whether it's true or false. And so this interesting idea, a person who likes to preserve the truth, someone who wants to be truthful, cannot in a truthful way come out based on those categories, say this is true. So this is an interesting, the preserver of truth, to preserve the truth. So I think many people like to be truthful. So how do you talk about your religious faith, your religious beliefs, in such a way you talk about it while you can still be truthful about how you talk? And that's what Kunki asks next. He asks the Buddha, in what way is there preservation of truth? How does one preserve truth? So how do you preserve the truth when you're talking about kind of your religious beliefs? And the Buddha answers like this. If a person has faith, the person preserves truth by saying, my faith is thus. But that person does not yet come to the definite conclusion, only this is true, anything else is wrong. In this way, there's a preservation of truth. If a person approves of something, the person does not. The person says, my approval is this. This is what I approve of. But they don't claim this is true. When you hold something on oral tradition, you say, oh, it's from based on oral tradition that I have this view. But you don't say, this is truth. You say, this is my oral tradition that I rely on. When you use your reasoning, you make that you source your claim to your reasoning. I've thought it out. And this is what my thinking brought me to. But I don't really know if it's true or not. But my reasoning brings me this far. So in this way, there's preservation of truth. This way, you don't have to reject the views that you're operating on, but you understand the source of authority upon which you're holding them. And this idea of looking, understanding, what authority do you have your views, I think is a very interesting one. And then if you understand it's one of these five, then you would say so. You know, I read it in the paper this morning. Is that true? You know, as opposed to, you know, saying, you know, those people, you know, who knows what those people are like. But I read in the paper today about these people somewhere, those politicians. And, you know, I don't know what's true or not true, but this is what it says in the paper. So to be careful about the source of your knowledge as opposed to making truth statements that you don't really have a basis for. I think it's going to be a great thing for our society, for people to be more careful this way. So the Buddha said, this is how you preserve the truth. But then the Buddha ends the little teaching here by saying, but as of yet, there is no discovery of truth. So there's preserving the truth in terms of making a statement which is true, but the person hasn't discovered what's true. And here we come into the section about how to be a student. So then the Kunki asks, well, how do you discover the truth for yourself? How do you know and see for yourself? And so So it goes this way. So you're living in your town, and here I use the example of a monastic, Buddhist monastic. There's a Buddhist monastic, a teacher in your town. And so you're interested in spirituality, religious teachings or something. And so you go to this person, and the first thing you do with a teacher is you examine the teacher. You test the teacher. You check out the teacher. So the first responsibility of a student is not to blindly accept the teacher because of they've written books or because they sit up on a little platform or because, you know, whatever reason. But maybe because they're sitting on a platform, you're willing to give them just enough benefit of the doubt that you're going to examine them carefully. Find out what's going on. And the examination the Buddha recommends is you want to examine them carefully to find out whether they're influenced or caught up in greed, hate, or delusion. And I don't think it says it here, but it says in other places where the Buddha gives the same teaching, he says, you can't really know this unless you've hung out with someone for a long time. And so, you know, it offers some challenges. How do you spend time with someone to check them out, find out, you know, are they reasonably not caught up in greed, hate, and delusion? Because if they are, then the idea is that that's going to influence what they teach. Also, the idea in Buddhism is to teach what you know. And one of the key things we're trying to know or experience in Buddhism is freedom from greed, hate, and delusion. So you want to check out whether the person is free of those things or has some reasonable freedom from them or work through them enough that they have something to teach. So you want to check out the teacher. So that, of course, puts us teachers on the hot spot. And how you're going to do that, I don't know. But I do know that, it's a little bit, sometimes you need to come for a long time to hear someone, listen to someone, or you need to find ways to hang out with them and outside of the necessarily formal teaching role. Sometimes the formal teaching role is kind of formal and kind of like there's a little, you don't really get the full person in that context. And so the person might seem, we've had lots of examples of brilliant teachers, people have been brilliant in the formal teacher role, and in their private life, it's been kind of a mess. So how do you find out, and how do you check people out? But that's part of the task, that's part of the responsibility of a student. So then, once you've done the job of checking out the teacher, the monastic or whatever, then the next step in this process of discovering truth is to offer here the translation is place your faith in that person. Offer the person some trust, some confidence. And remember, to be a student means you're willing to put yourself through change. You're willing to be open to become different in the process. And so if you're going to encounter a teacher or teachings, you want to have some faith and confidence in those teachings. Otherwise, you probably should be more careful about going into them with some openness and receptivity. But without some confidence and trust, you're not going to listen. You're not going to show up. So that, some is required. Some offering of faith and trust. And it's interesting to look at oneself and say, is there some faith? Or is there resistance? Is doubt? Has the upper hand. And so whenever the teacher is saying, has strong reservations, you're criticizing, you're saying no, no, no. And maybe there's a good reason to say no, but perhaps also then you're closed to take in what's being said. So then you have some faith and trust in the person. And based on that, some modicum of confidence or trust, then the next step in discovering a truth is to visit the teacher. In other words, come and hear a talk, hear teachings, meet the person, be willing to actually do something. So this idea of visiting, going forth, you can't just sit in the privacy of your living room, but the actual contact. And there's been a long tradition in Buddhism is that It's really important, the personal connection. Doesn't mean that necessarily you're friends, but that you encounter the Dharma face to face. It's more embodied. It's more rich than reading it in a book, for example, where you don't really get so much. You don't get the fullness behind it. Then the next step in this variety of steps in what a student does to discover the truth is pays respect. So there's some offering of respect to a teacher, which is an ancient tradition. And in fact, in Buddhism, you're not supposed to teach unless there's some modicum of respect. People have been being disrespectful, you're just wasting your time teaching. And so, you know, why bother? In some cultures, the respect for teachers is very high, and some cultures, the respect of teachers is not so high. Here in the modern America, perhaps because of the very strong egalitarian emphasis that exists in parts of our culture, there's a kind of reluctance to have teachers elevated or to offer a lot of respect. And it's interesting for me to some people who come here to IMC from cultures where teachers are given a lot of respect are a bit shocked at how some of you treat the teachers. And it's just because it's so different from what they're used to in their culture. I'm not suggesting you change at all, but it's just, you know, different cultures have different ways. But some modicum of respect is suggested as part of the path of discovering the truth. So investigate, place faith, visit, pays respect, and then listens to the teacher. Remember, back in ancient India, there was no books, so it was all oral. You had to listen. Maybe nowadays we can add maybe reading their books or listening to audio dharma. You have to do something in addition. So listen. So you have to take in the teachings. You have to listen to the teachings. The next step is interesting. Remember, it's an oral culture back then. They didn't have books. The next step was to memorize what you heard. And now you don't have to do that necessarily if you have, you know, your book nearby and you've taken notes of the talk, or you have your Kindle or something, smartphones. I know some people have smartphones and they have all the Buddhist sutras downloaded into their phone, so they don't have to memorize anything. They just go on their little phone and look it up. But there's something, it isn't just a matter of, you know, having access to it, because since there weren't books in the ancient world, if you don't have access to teachings to be able to revisit them, you had to memorize them. But it wasn't just a matter of just having access to them. I believe there's something very significant happens in the psyche, in the mind, when you've taken them in so deeply or so fully that they've been memorized. They live in there in a more full embodied way. We massage them, we work them, they work on us in a very different way. And I strongly recommend that people do a little bit of memorization in the Dharma, whether it's just memorizing some of the lists, you know, list of five, or whether it's memorizing a passage or a poem of the Dharma or something. But have something that you're kind of, it's working on you in a way that works differently than when you actually have memorized it. The next step is an important one, and this can be done whether you memorize it or not. And this is you examine it. So this is where whatever you've received, you don't receive them and accept it blindly. Even though you might respect and pay respects and have faith in the teacher, you don't accept the teachings. You just, this is how it is, this is the truth. Just because this person's a teacher means it's true. The responsibility of a student is to examine what's been taught, to reflect on it, to reason with it, to argue with it, to challenge it, to, you know, grapple with it, you know, whatever ways. And there's many different ways to engage. Maybe on different days and different settings you engage in different ways. But I don't think it's useful to just passively hear some teaching and say, well, because it's being said this way, it must be true. You want to engage in it. You want to personalize it. Make it personal. Make it your own. You want to massage it, challenge it. So I think it's really great when people challenge the teachings, question it. I think it's better to question and challenge, and in the process maybe learn than it is to just blindly accept. And then once it's been examined well enough, then it suggests the next step is reflective acceptance. Reflective acceptance here means because you've reflected on it and reasoned with it and examined it, then there's a preliminary acceptance of the teachings you've heard. And the preliminary acceptance is because you don't know for yourself yet, you haven't discovered the truth yet, but you're going to accept these teachings just enough so you can test them out. You're going to try it. And so once you've kind of had this reflective acceptance, then there comes motivation, to be motivated to apply, to engage in the practice, to do something with them. It's not, Buddhism is not for the passive. There's a kind of active quality to Buddhism. You have to do something. You can't just get knowledge and kind of go along with that. And then there's practicing. So this is really key. So the responsibility of a student, from the Buddhist point of view, is once you've gone through these careful steps initially, then you start practicing. You practice what you've heard. You practice what those teachings are. The teachings might not be true. They might not be right for you. But you've examined them well enough that you're willing to give them a try. And you'll discover in the trying, in the effort, whether this works for you or not. So the practicing. The next step is also interesting, I think. Once you've practiced for a while, then it says, the Buddha said, you should evaluate. The word is actually, I think Pali word is to weigh, to evaluate the what's happening for you. How's this working? What have you learned? Where's it going? How you've changed? Is this helpful for you? How is it helpful? Is it not helpful? How is it not helpful? So it's not, again, just a passive, blind acceptance of a practice, because the practice of mindfulness, for example, should be true. The teachers say it's true. There's now something like 1,000 books in English on mindfulness and eating, mindfulness and depression. There's mindfulness and Angry Birds. And there's even a book, Mindfulness and Poker. So, you know, it must be true, right? This mindfulness must be, you know, useful everywhere. So, no, you want to try, you know, you have the teaching of mindfulness or you have some meditation practice, you try it out, you test it. And maybe it needs to be adjusted for you. Maybe your way of practicing is different than someone else's. So the evaluation is important. As we evaluate and see that it's helpful and useful, some preliminary helpfulness and usefulness, the next step here, the word in English that's been given by Bhikkhu Bodhi is strive. The person strives. And I don't know what to make of this, but except that once you've kind of checked it out, tested it for yourself a little bit, and seen that, well, it looks like it works, looks like it's good, then at some point you give yourself over to it more fully, to the practice. You apply yourself more fully, so striving or persistence or more full turning yourself over to it. So it could be, for example, like going on a retreat in our tradition. You've tried it out, you've practiced at home, meditation. Seems like meditation is useful. And you have some confidence in how it all goes. And so you're going to really put yourself wholeheartedly into it for a while and go on a 7-day retreat and see how it pans out there. And then, in that wholeheartedness, really putting yourself in fully into the practice, then at some point it matures, comes to fruition, when one realizes with the body the truth. And so the expression in ancient expression time of the Buddha, one realizes with the body the truth, is actually two statements. But the first one, realizing with the body, I think this what means in the ancient world is that you've seen it directly, you've realized it directly. So with your body, it's experiential truth as opposed to reason truth or passive truth because you've just accepted it from someone else. You've experienced it for yourself. So, for example, if someone tells you that, when it's raining, you'll in the winter time, you'll stay warmer if you wear a rain jacket. you know, that's a reasonable thing. You've never been to this winter or to the rain, but then you put on the rain jacket, and then you experience how the rain jacket keeps you dry. If your teachings are that it's better not to lie, your life is better, then it's one thing to believe that. It's another thing to actually have a direct experience of what it feels like to be truthful. And then you know for yourself, a direct experience, what it feels like. It's one thing to know that, you know, reasonably, you know, it seems reasonable that meditation is helpful, de-stresses you. It's another thing to actually experience the de-stress, how you're calm. And so when you experience the lack of stress, it's a direct, you feel it in your body, it's a direct experience. And then you know for yourself, oh yes, meditation really relieves stress. So coming eventually to a direct experience is the goal. And once you have a direct experience, then the Buddha said, you have discovered the truth. And so the whole momentum of practice is to become a discoverer of the truth. So you don't have to preserve the truth carefully by saying, you know, based on this, you know, my on a book or faith or something. But now you know for yourself. You know and see for yourself. So it might seem like a lot to do. And, you know, this unfolds slowly over time. Some of this happens, I think, kind of naturally without being so, you know, intentional about it. But, you know, I think the principle behind this has to do with the responsibility that students have. And how do you engage responsibly with a Buddhist tradition, with Buddhist teachings? And how do you come to be a person who knows this for yourself directly? And so here are some suggestions of ways to do this. Teachings to Kanki. So that's what I had in mind for today. So do you have any, we have some time if you have any comments about that or questions. Yes, Arthur. This is quick and
So as you were speaking, I was thinking when the Buddha was teaching this, he was teaching something new. That was a departure from, I guess, what was understood at the time. So we are in a situation where there's many teachers. There's the Dharma. There's Vipassana, a doctrine, I guess we could say. There's many teachers, and many of us here have tested, if that's the right word. The doctrine, and also some of the teachers. I guess the point of my question is that our situation today here is a little bit different than it would have been for that Brahmin who was coming to the Buddha to see if his teaching and the teacher were true.
I'm sure I follow you, but you know, back in the time of the Buddha, there were a lot of different spiritual teachers going around with different spiritual teachings, and I mean, it was apparently pretty rich and diverse. And just like it, you know, I don't know if it's just like it is here in California, but you know, we have a lot of diversity here too. So, how do we? The question is, how do we deal with all the diversity? How do we find our way through it all? And then even in Buddhism, you find all the, even in our Vipassana traditions, there are different teachers. And so how do you find your way through that? Is that the question? I think that it's also possible to evaluate not only a teacher, but also a tradition or a collective or a community. So it's possible to look at the, you know, I'm part of a network of insight meditation teachers, and we meet regularly. I'm part of the Spirit Rock Teachers Council, and you know, here at IMC we have, you know, Andrea Fella and myself are the co-teachers. There's you know, the wider scene of IMS and teachers there. So it's also possible to get a sense of the wider kind of the community, and also there's people like, there's the practitioners who practice. And you could also kind of a little bit look at the people and the culture and how people are and say, you know, is this these people kind of, is it okay with me, these people? You know, they seem to be a little bit free of greed and hate and delusion. You don't want to have too high standards for practitioners because... because it's the people who have these problems who need the practice. So they're the ones who want to come, and you know, they need to come to practice and work through this stuff. But I think it's also reasonable to be able to, you know, to evaluate a community and say, does it seem overall that this community is representing values, representing ways of being that seem in harmony with what's being taught or what the purpose is? And if it isn't, then go someplace else. And then so also the teachers as a whole, does it seem like a teachers as a whole? I think it's okay. Or some teachers work and some teachers don't. And so there's a natural selection process that goes on. So I'm not sure if I'm answering your question because I wasn't sure your question.
As you were speaking, I was thinking about, particularly in this area, I'm a business professional, and I encounter a lot of people who teach. You know, there's sort of unsolicited teaching, if that makes sense. And
Let me tell you what to do about that.
It's just what I was going to ask. You got me there. So if I didn't designate that person as my teacher. Do you have any perspective on that? You know, how do I listen? Or
if the person is not your teacher?
Well, I didn't designate them. You know, yeah. I didn't seek them out for teaching. But yeah. I think that's a lot of how we talk to each other. I myself included. You know, I see myself doing that.
So it's a question for me to respond to. I should be careful here.
Well, I did designate you as my teacher. So yeah, I guess I would like to hear your perspective on that.
I don't think I have any simple answer for you. And sometimes people are worth listening to. Some people like to teach, and they do it a little bit too easily. But sometimes it's okay. You can just, you know, humor them and go along. And sometimes it's useful. It's interesting. And sometimes it's oppressive. And so sometimes it's you need to say, you know, please stop. You know, this is not the time and place. You're not my teacher. I mean, my wife had to tell me that at some point. Many years ago, when we were together before I was a teacher, but then at some point I started teaching enough that it became a little bit of a habit to be teaching. So I came home one day, I was talking to her one day, she said, "Gil, you're starting to use that voice." So,
I guess I'm thinking in terms of the, I don't know what you call them, you know, the five, or how many were there? The five sort of guidelines for list, you know, for being taught or being the recipient. You know, sometimes I guess I can make the decision that it's worth
listening to.
Worth listening to that degree or not, so.
Yeah, so, you know, I don't have any simple answer how to find your way through that, but it's certainly an interesting question, and you know, you have to pay attention to the particular circumstances in which it's happening to know whether you accept it, whether you stop it, or whether you do some wonderful Aikido with it, and say, oh, that's very interesting, and upon what basis do you believe that, or you kind of engage it, or question it back, or, you know, or teach them.
Thank you.
But I think it's one thing to have someone teach you unrequested, but I think it's always good to be careful about teaching other people unless it's been requested, unless it's somehow been asked. Or if you feel like you need to tell someone, ask them permission. You know, it would be okay if I tell you. I think it's best to do it that way. And so in Buddhism, that's the assumption, is you don't teach unless there's a request. And I haven't gotten the request at IMC for years because I think it's implicit that the request is here. But when I first started teaching for this group 20 years ago in Palo Alto, I didn't do anything unless the group asked me. And at some point it just, you know, when we had a one-day sitting, you know, I waited until people asked me, so let's do a one-day sitting, and let's do this. And at some point it became clear that it was kind of the expectation was I was supposed to kind of make the decisions, or the invitation was, the request was, Gil, don't let us keep having to ask you. Take some initiative. So after about 3-4 years, I kind of thought, okay, I got to not just wait because the invitation is implicit. So I hope that works for you. I mean, I assume that that's been kind of the deal. Otherwise, you wouldn't have come. I take your coming as the request. So, okay, so I hope that was nice. And if it wasn't nice, even better if it was challenging in a good way. So thank you.